I think it is a limiting belief that folks just want to understand the features and functionality. I think reps don't understand that, like, even C-suite folks, even VPs, do want to hear your opinion, because people don't want to, if you want information, you Google it or you ask ChatGPT, right? Information is so widely available. They want perspective. And maybe they don't agree with you. Maybe, hey, cost is the most important there. Maybe speed is, or maybe it's something else. It's not a fit, but getting there faster. And again, the respect that you get. And it's also more fun.
Hi, welcome to Path to Growth. I'm Tracy Young, co-founder and CEO of TigerEye. Today, we are joined by Ross Rich, co-founder and CEO of Accord. Ross, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Tracy. Excited to dive in here today.
So before we start talking about Accord, I want to go a little bit farther back. Will you tell me about mom and dad and growing up and what you learned from them?
Wow, we're getting very personal here. Definitely, people ask me, you know, was it a crazy idea to start Accord, start your own company? Well, not just my parents, but both grandparents on both sides were entrepreneurs. So yeah, moving from Eastern and Central Europe back in the early 1900s, both of them came to Toronto and New York respectively and built their own companies. And then, you know, both my parents have been very entrepreneurial. So yeah, definitely learned a lot. And I think it's more of just the, like, I wouldn't say expectation is probably the wrong word, but that it's like not a crazy thing to go out and try something. So I feel like my brother's also one of our co-founders here at Accord. It didn't feel like it was a wild idea to leave our jobs at Stripe and Google to give founding Accord a shot.
What did you learn from them? Other than them being really supportive of both your entrepreneurial journey. And I'm sure they're so proud. So I've got three sons. And the idea of them getting older and starting a company together is so outrageously sweet to me, because they're at the age, they're like 6 and 4 and a 4-month-old, but they're like fist fighting. The older kids are fist fighting all the time. So to imagine them being older and working together is like magical to me. So tell me about what you learned from your mom and dad.
Yeah, very specifically, I'd say hard work and persistence come top of mind. So my mom was originally really passionate about design. And so she got into FIT in New York, graduated, I think, a year and a half early from her small town in Batavia in upstate New York. It was a very hard worker, struggled, I think, you know, with some things around school, but just outworked everyone and was able to, you know, despite not coming naturally, actually graduate early and get into her kind of dream program, ended up hating it. Just like very different moving from small town to New York, the big city. And I think was passionate about other parts of design that weren't necessarily related to school. I ended up going to accounting at Syracuse and again, worked super hard and got an amazing job after. And I think something that I've definitely taken from her is, you know, both follow your passion. So I actually started my career in the music industry in New York. So very similar path, and then ended up, you know, not liking it and ended up moving to San Francisco and falling in love with technology and B2B sales. But that idea of, like, if you just kind of stay persistent, consistent, you know, follow what you're passionate about, but also just really work hard, I think leads to good things. So I think both of them have very much taught me, you know, the power of just kind of putting in the hours and staying consistent and persistent.
That's wonderful. Thanks for sharing that. So you spent some time in the music industry, and I have so many questions there, but we're going to focus on Accord. You were a B2B sales leader and you spent your time doing that in tech. Tell me about the moment where you decided to, like, quit your high paying sales leader job and to become, you know, a starving startup founder.
I think it was probably 80% pull into doing that and a 20% push. The push being, you know, I was at Stripe for about 5 years. I absolutely loved it, going from literally no CRM, not knowing what to say to customers, what is even the idea of a demo at Stripe, to, you know, being part of a 500 plus global go-to-market and sales machine. I think at the beginning, it was really exciting because it's like, how do you pitch this product? Who do we talk to? How do we get a CRM and actually handle lead route? Like, literally all of the 0 to 1 problems, I really, really enjoyed kind of the first principles, think of like, how do you solve this, especially not coming from sales? And we didn't take a lot of like the classic playbooks. It was a lot of like figure it out. And I really, really enjoyed that. And doing it from the field, right? Like doing that, being on the front lines with other sellers and with our customers. it got to a point after, you know, selling the first of a kind deals and, you know, working on all these exciting partnerships where it kind of felt, you know, monotonous in a way. It's like, hey, like we're going to go do another thing. And some people love that, like scale up. It was like, how do we do this from, you know, 20 to 200 and 200 to 2000? It was like, it felt like a lot of the 0 to 1 problems weren't around anymore. And I was kind of looking at like, what's my path here? Like doing my boss's job, my boss's job, like that is less of what I was passionate about. And the thing that I got really excited about was working with our VP of sales and head of RevOps and enablement around kind of building process and repeatability around what we had figured out from that 0 to 1. So it's like, how do we then help other people understand when we have a, you know, new hire class of 20 AEs, how to do what we've learned? And it felt like everyone that came in after me had to also figure stuff out, which to me was mind boggling because I'm like, makes no sense. We've already figured this stuff out. Why does everyone else have to figure out how to sell to these different types of deals? So that's where I got passionate about the idea behind Accord. It was less of starting a business. It was more about just getting really obsessed around this problem that seemed honestly very silly of like, hey, you figured out how to sell these things. We have, you know, billions of dollars of valuation and hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue. Like, shouldn't a new person be able to join and learn from what other people have learned already? And it felt like starting from scratch because we just would update Salesforce fields or stage names or have these internal playbooks. And it's like, oh, here's how to sell. It's like, that's not how sales works. So that's kind of led me down the path of founding Accord.
Yeah, it's really unbelievable. Having been able to see a lot of sales ramp time, and it's like, wow, you know, even at these really big companies, we're talking about like 9 months before they're expecting their rep to bring in any revenue. It's like, it really takes 9 months to train them up. So tell us about Accord and the problems you guys solve.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a great point. It's like, and I think part of it may be because I didn't come from sales and I felt like, hey, these people are professionals of their craft. They should be able to come in and learn a new industry and be able to apply their training. And like kind of this perspective of like, they should be better than me, like low ego. Like, hey, I'm not that like great and unique. Like if these people were doing things before, they should be able to come in. That just wasn't the case. So yeah, Accord's all about how do you not just create repeatable, consistent go-to-market motions, but really value selling. Like that's the thing that I also really got passionate about was like being that consultative salesperson. How do you become a master of your domain and market? And there's so much information out there for buyers is like, despite the role disparity, like kind of difference between like an AE and selling to someone in the C-suite or VP, I always really enjoyed the fact that I could confidently come in and know more about this tiny domain than them, right? Like I started to be pitched to a lot of CTOs and chief product officers. It was like, hey, you are so much further in your career. You know all about this thing. You're at this amazing company. But when it comes to payment processing, when it comes to this thing, I've worked with hundreds of companies and we know this. And that's what I really, really enjoy. And I think that's why a lot of sellers enjoy their job of they can add a lot of value from that. And how do you build that into the culture of your sales organization? I think typically people expect the top performers to do that, but not everyone. I was like, that should just be the expectation is we can all do this. And how do you think about operationalizing that across your go-to-market team? So that's kind of the problem space that we get really excited about and kind of surprised that the alternatives again are, you know, these massive Salesforce projects or, you know, hiring a trainer or one of these big consulting shops. You get everyone stoked for the SKO or, you know, some training and, you know, launching some new methodology. And then you all just go back to the status quo a couple quarters later. So just kind of the expectation from sellers, I feel like is sometimes too low and that we should be shooting for kind of a higher bar for execution.
Yeah, two things you said really resonate with me. One, with value selling, I mean, having been in sales for a long time, I think all CEOs and founders are in sales, regardless of what industry you're in, because you're always selling your vision and your mission and your product and maybe even your company. I have found that, and I think myself included, you know, as a purchaser of products, I don't want to be sold to by a salesperson. I want to be sold to by a trusted business partner, like an expert who's going to help me bring some rhyme and reason and like clarity to this chaos of running my business, right? So that makes a lot of sense to me. And then also, why is it that every single big company thinks that they need to bring on an outside trainer? Like, why is that a good idea? This group, okay, yes, I'm sure they've got good toolkits, but they have never sold their thing before. Meanwhile, let's hire them for like several hundred thousand dollars and have them train our sales team. It has never made sense to me. And I've sat in these like presentations and it's like, wow, why did we waste a boatload of money on this?
It's a good question. And I honestly do think that there's space for it, but that it needs to be a mixture of those best practices, I mean, translated to the company, but then also reinforced. And that's, I think, the biggest missing piece. Like if you look at the cost spent at one of these big companies, maybe they'll spend, you know, 500K plus on one of these big, you know, trainers, consultancies, whatever. Yes, it's good to reinforce those best practices. And yes, if you have a big sales team, you can kind of do the math of, you know, how much is it worth for being able to sell bigger deals and higher ACVs and ramp time and all that good stuff. But then, yes, you need the internal teams to be able to translate that to what are those great discovery questions for us? What is that kind of ROI math for us? How do we do all this stuff? And then it's got to continue from there. And I would ballpark probably a 90%, 10% split of money and investment spent on that big moment, that big SKO, that big trainer coming in, and the 10% on the reinforcement, because it's not sexy, right? Doing the big moment, having people come to the SKO, getting everyone stoked is exciting and gets budget. And the day-to-day reinforcement, how we're doing deal reviews, how we're asking questions, how we're translating this to the customer-facing meetings, like, doesn't get the excitement and investment and time from the C-suite and from the VPs. It's really misunderstood of what it's like on the ground. And I think this problem only gets bigger the more levels there are. And the level between AE and, you know, VP CRO who's making these decisions at even a mid-market company could be four different levels, right? AE, manager, director, senior director, VP. And I think they lose out on what's truly happening. And what are those conversations like with your customers on the field? And they are very different than, I think, the best practice examples they think, you know, that we champion at the kind of trainer level.
So what lessons from your sales days do you bring and carry with you as founder and CEO?
I think kind of what you mentioned around how customers want to be treated and how they want to work with you, I think it is a limiting belief that folks just want to understand the features and functionality. I think reps don't understand that, like, even C-suite folks, even VPs, do want to hear your opinion. And I think, again, it comes to that, like, huge separation between how you think about engaging with your VP or other VPs internally. And when you're external, that confidence that you should have of, I do understand the status quo. I do understand the alternatives. I do understand the space so much more than anyone else could. And being an expert in your domain and being able to offer opinions. And so that's one of the things that I take forward to both, you know, our team, but also the product. Like, how can we give confidence to the AEs, CSMs, SEs that are interfacing with customers and being able to drive a more prescriptive kind of guided motion? Because people don't want to, if you want information, you Google it or you ask ChatGPT, right? Information is so widely available. They want perspective. And maybe they don't agree with you. Maybe, hey, cost is the most important there. Maybe speed is, or maybe it's something else. It's not a fit, but getting there faster. And again, the respect that you get. And it's also more fun. Like, I find it more fun to engage with people when you're having a thoughtful conversation instead of just going through the laundry list of features and functionality. So I think there's a lot of benefits, and that's kind of what we're trying to champion, is those kind of aha moments for sellers and teams around how they should be going to market.
Mm-hmm. I was reading the study that was published by Duke, and it talked about people using AI for their work, but then hiding it from their peers because there's a stigma and they don't want their peers or bosses know that they're using AI. And I was reminded by that because you just recently said, you know, just look for it in ChatGPT, just get your answer there. So how do you think of, let's talk about it. Like, what do you think about AI? And is there areas of your business where you are, like, scaling back and investing more for an AI?
Well, maybe just to kind of carry that thread, like you mentioned, I think that's a perfect example of, like, where AI comes in and where the human comes in. If you want to get spun up on your customer, you know, either your own space, if you're a newer seller in the go-to-market team of your own company, or to really understand your client, to do that research really quickly, to pull all the that stuff takes time. That could save you, you know, maybe 3 hours of initial research before a C-suite call that you worked really hard to get. That's not how you're going to engage with them, though, right? You're not going to just, you know, you're going to ingest that information, maybe write, like, a nice pre-read or overview about it and show that you understand their space. But that's not the customer-facing thing. I think you need to, again, ingest that and apply your point of view. So again, I think it's a really great way of bringing in a lot more information really effectively and summarizing it. I don't think it's how I'd probably want my team to show up to $1 million potential deal and just spit out all that information. I want them to internalize it and say, oh, based on what I learned about your business in, which probably took 20 minutes instead of 2 or 3 hours, this is how we think we can work together to develop a stronger point of view and more informed point of view. So I think that kind of applies, you know, how we think about AI both internally and with our product. So like, for example, our engineering team, you know, started using GitHub Copilot and then ended up trying out Cursor and Windsurf. They ended up going with Windsurf. They're able to not outsource, you know, kind of outsource some of the basics for more of having a product mind and perspective. So it's not like they're outsourcing and AI is just doing it. It's saving them time on some of the really kind of groundwork stuff to be able to then interpret and use the perspective about the customer and the workflows and the things that we want to achieve with their vehicle, which is code, similar to the research example with, you know, internalizing that and having our perspective for customers. So I think it can make really good people great or excellent. Like I think about, you know, the limiting factor for your top AEs maybe being time. Maybe they can only work 2 enterprise deals and close 2, you know, $1 million deal accounts. What happens if that could be a 3rd or 4th? Because for them, it's not necessarily, they're not like, oh, I hope I get luck. It's like, they're great at it. Well, if they could save time on some of these things, maybe they could be even more efficient. I don't think that helps someone who doesn't have the right point of view and doesn't know how to work with customers be more effective. If you have a 15, 20% win rate, well, it's probably not going to help increase that and you're still not going to be great. Same thing on the engineering side, probably points out people that are making worse product decisions because they're building in more bugs and they're making worse product decisions that are compounding. So they compound some of the bad work. And I think it, you know, accelerates some of the great work.
How do you see B2B deal execution evolving over the next 10 years?
It's a big question. Again, I think it ties back to what we were just talking about in terms of the, you know, with the tools that we have and related to AI is kind of what we saw with, I think, some of this like mass outbound email type stuff with, you know, outreach and others were like, hey, it became so easy to do that. It kind of got commoditized and then now like ruin the inbox. I think the same kind of thing, if you have all these agents and automations going on, you need to elevate. And I think actually this consultative value selling that, you know, a fraction of people and teams are able to execute on, that the bar goes up and those are the teams that are going to do even better. I actually think the job of these great sales leaders and reps are more valued over time. And I think it kind of breaks away from the rest, similar to engineering, right? Hey, if everyone can kind of code like a junior coder, like then the product decisions you're making and integration decisions and connectivity, those things are even more valued. So I think the top of the top elevates, and then it's like kind of who's going to elevate and figure that out and who's not. So that's kind of my read on it. 10 years is very far out. Maybe that's my guess for like the next 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
But I think people want, again, decisions matter even more in that world. And I think, again, people want that consultative. I think they care more about peers too. I think it's more of this like advisory type role in decisions, even more so. I think people value their peers' feedback more. So you need to have a relationship across an ecosystem, not just their peers, but other players in the space. Like that's where I think the great sellers and go-to-market teams are going to be focused.
Yeah. When we go out and talk about our product and what we solve for our customers, there is a little bit of fear because we, you know, we automate a big chunk of what they do. You're just not munging numbers on spreadsheets anymore. You have AI calculate stuff for you and you can have Tigerize AI like create all your graphs for you instantaneously without work from a data team or a RevOps team. And what we remind them is there's like a big chunk of their job that is literally talking with other people and getting buy-in and like coming up with tactics and strategy and then actual execution. Yeah. AI can never do any of that. And so
that differentiation goes up. Exactly agree. Mm-hmm. So the things that you need to be uniquely good at become more important.
Yep.
Exactly.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then I also agree that, man, all of the like outreach and the like the ruining of the inbox, it's so true. I was just thinking like, man, every morning I go into my Gmail and I literally sit there for about 5 minutes clicking through, unsubscribing to things I've never signed up for, and then just deleting outbound outreach of cold emails that weren't written by humans. And then when I do get a thoughtful email, or maybe it was written by AI, but someone like prompt engineered the heck out of it, right? And it looked like a really good email that I was like really pulled into. Like that really sets things apart for me.
it probably stood out more because you've got all those bad ones. And that's what I'm trying to tell people is like, I think it's getting easier in a way if you really do a great job, similar to your example of like, hey, the great people that are using AI tools in your space are going to be doing exponentially more work than their peers. But it's, again, it's more of the like kind of taste and thoughtfulness part comes in. So like the best can get better and get more work done. The rest, it's going to be even harder to be able to, you know, stand out and really be worth the difference between and the delta between the agent and you if you're not getting better at your craft.
You know how your handwriting just becomes total shit when you don't write for a long, long time? And, you know, you see this during like Christmas time. It's like, wow, why is this so hard to just write a Christmas card? And it's like, oh, right, because I like type most of the time. I type my notes now. And I think the same thing's going to happen with writing. Like so many people I see are just sending me AI generated writing that they're going to, that muscle is going to atrophy and they're not going to be able to write anymore, which is kind of funny.
That is a really, really good point. And it's funny because I actually think AI, so many people haven't been writing for so long, it's kind of better than the average, but then it's so much worse than when people are excellent at it and how persuasive and how thoughtful it can come if it's from like a really, really, you know, craftful writer.
A beautiful piece of writing. Yeah, exactly.
It's persuasive, it's whatever. And but I do think because I don't know, the bar for writing, whatever it is, like is incredibly low. I see in the business world, even from like some senior people, no, I'm not worried about grammar. I'm not worried about any of that stuff, but just like, you know, the quality of some paragraphs that I get, I'm like, this is shockingly not great. All that kind of stuff. So I'm like, I think it actually maybe helps some of the, you know, the average, but like you're not going to be able to ever take that away. And that's where I feel like some people are minimizing again those kind of like the really excellent things to stand out. I don't think, and maybe I guess there, like I think that's what makes us human in some ways, is that like EQ and understanding and, you know, contextual choices that you're never going to have. But maybe we get worse as a society around some things because we just rely on it more and more.
Yeah, but as you said, the best is still going to be there. You know what makes, there's like a conveyor belt of music happening that's written by AI, but it's like, that's not really, I mean, it's impressive, but it's not stuff I listen to because the music I listen to has a human perspective to it.
And sometimes purposely worse in a way is better. Like, I used to be doing the music world is like sometimes having that, you know, lo-fi static. Sometimes why do people like to listen to vinyl? It's because it feels differently. And can you get that feeling? It's again, such a human thing. I don't know if, you know, again, because it'll change and then the average changes and everyone gets used to this. And then you're like purposefully not doing that. And I think only the best of the best to really understand that dimension.
So as CEO, what are the most important responsibilities you have to your team and the company?
Everything. I'll have to prioritize, but I definitely feel responsible for everything. Like if something doesn't happen, it's not because of the person that I asked that didn't do it right. It was probably because I wasn't explicit enough or, you know, it's I feel that responsibility for any outcome or input. But if I were a stack rank, like if I only did certain things, keeping the lights on, you know, I forget, you know, whatever the great, you know, YC or founder expressions around, you know, like just don't run out of money, don't run out of money, don't run out of money. Probably the top three things. You could solve a lot of other things with time. I think it's really direction. I think you like, right, they say you can hire great people and get out of the way, but like without direction, you can't just hire great people. Like they look at you. And I feel like when I look at companies that might have like a non-founder CEO sometimes, or kind of, you know, like wandering around, it's typically because they're not driving in a place. And like, you can be really successful going pretty hard into an area that might not be right, but doing it well. I think the challenge is when a lot of people are kind of wandering and like you already mentioned, it's harder for people to make decisions than ever because there's so much concern and social pressure about making the wrong decision. It feels like people are so worried about making the wrong decision, they're making no decisions and for a really long time. So I think my responsibility is having conviction and making decisions and providing that direction, learning from that and then shifting quickly. And that's, I think, the superpower of a startup is the speed and not getting too tied up of, you know, I think we're fine if we make the wrong decision, as long as we're conscious of it and learn from that. I think the biggest concern is we don't have that conviction and confidence and don't end up making decisions. So that's probably where I would don't run out of money and make sure we're going in a path, learning from it and changing it. If I could do those two things, we'll probably be all right.
I think that's a really good summarization of your role as CEO. So how has your definition of success changed? Is it still, I mean, obviously the financial targets are important.
Yeah, honestly, I think the thing that drove me was, again, more of that experience, the visceral experience that I had at Stripe, getting really passionate about sales, getting really passionate about doing the right craft with me and my team, trying to translate that to everyone and just not working and being like, we'll be successful if we kind of build this new way of for the people that were the Rosses of the world and my team, the VP of sales, enablement ops, of like, instead of changing fields in Salesforce, instead of trying to hire a trainer, instead of doing these things, there's a new way, a better way to drive this value-based go-to-market process. Like, hey, there's a more field-friendly way, there's a more customer-friendly way, there's a more opposite, like internal way of, we expect this out of our team. We want our people to be advisors. We want our people to have point to run a process. Like, that's really at the heart of why, you know, I'm still working on this instead of, you know, anything else the last 5 or so years. So success to me is that existing. Whether it's, you know, people ask me, oh, what's the goal? IPO, acquisition, this thing. It's like the market gets to decide that. I think if I learned anything through this founder experience in the last turbulent 5 years and market post-COVID and everything that's happened, is you only have so much control. The market has so much more control, and thinking that you do is just like probably not the right way of running your business and understanding what you can control and working within there. And so, yeah, if you know, if it makes sense in, you know, 5 years and the market's big enough and we get to, you know, whatever 200 mil plus, whatever the milestone is to go public at that time, that probably makes the most sense. If it's there's adjacent companies and products doing similar things and there's a huge push in the market to consolidate, well, it's probably not doing the opposite of that at a long enough time, then we run out of money, et cetera, et cetera. So it's kind of, I feel like it's a really bad non-answer. It's kind of like, you know, doing the right thing in the basis of the market. But if it was like saying one thing, well, that might not be the right thing. That might not be the organic thing, the right thing to do for the company and for the product and for the mission of kind of up-leveling the expectation for B2B sales to happen. Could be some other path. So
what surprised you the most about founding your own company and running it?
How hard it is.
It's true. It's, you know, even as a second time founder, it's surprising how hard it is. But let's talk about like, describe it to people who don't do this or who are thinking about starting a company, why it's hard.
Yeah. There's a lot of ways that I've tried to like articulate this. One way that I think does a decent job is, so again, if you're a hard worker, right, you're probably the type of person to start a company, just to compare it to being at a great company, maybe early stage and growing and feeling like you experienced what it was like to be a founder. You can't compare what it feels like when you have some sort of product market fit or have some sort of momentum and you're not just starting from nothing. The difference of energy that goes into getting something started isn't the difference between like pushing a ball, a rock on a flat surface or even slightly uphill and then it going downhill. It's like fully vertical. Like, you don't understand. I think like when I compare the hours that I worked, let's say at Stripe compared to at Accord, I can't work the same hours. I can't work as many hours that I work on Accord because the pressure, the stress, like how much harder it is to spend that hour of thinking and changing context and having to be aware of so many different variables when you don't get something started and moving in a certain direction. You have to think so much more. And there's so much more pressure. Whereas again, like I could go through a 10-hour day, do all this stuff at Stripe, like win these deals, do these things, blah, blah, blah. Like, oh, I know what I put in and I know what I got out. At the beginning of a startup, you might not be getting out anything. So that motivation, that energy that goes into it, that's like the best way I can, you know, poorly articulate this, is the things you're getting back isn't comparable to being at a company that has some semblance of a product and product market fit and all these things, because you're worrying constantly. You don't know what you need to work on. Especially if it's a new product, new vertical, new all this kind of stuff, you're kind of wandering and testing a million things out and then like, oh, this thing went well, let's adjust here. Oh, this thing went well, blah, blah, blah. So that I kind of think of it from like the energy level, why it's so hard, because you're not necessarily getting as much back in terms of that positive feedback from the market when you're still, you don't know what's working. So you feel like you kind of need to constantly worry and think about all these things, because you might be the next call, the next idea might be like the thing that makes it work. And you don't know what that's going to be. So you feel like you kind of need to do everything all the time. Curious how that relates to your two experiences starting companies, Tracy.
There's this wonderful Winston Churchill quote, and it goes, "When you find yourself in hell, keep walking." And I think it's such a wonderful summary of founding a company, because that's it. You have no choice. You just keep going, because the moment you stop is the moment your thing ends. Doesn't matter where you're at, even if you're in hell, you just keep going.
Yeah. And it feels so different on the outside, right? Like you see the things, I see the things that I post because, you know, you want to share things when it's good and like get that excitement and all that kind of stuff. You don't see the really, really, really challenging days where you feel like nothing's happening. You feel like you've been working on this for all that kind of stuff. And then you look back and you're like, oh, wow, we're here now. And like, I couldn't imagine a year ago being here. But then the days in between or the hours, the nights, like it doesn't feel like that whatsoever.
Yeah. And those are the moments it's really important to look up once in a while and see how far you've come. Even if it's just a quarter, like look where we're at 3 months ago. It's not too shabby.
Yeah.
We are a family founding team also. I'm married to my co-founder. I'm curious, I'm sure you and your brother fight. And it's so funny to found a company with a family member, because the conversations are different than the rest of the team, right? You can actually be rude to each other. During off work hours.
Which I think is a good and a bad thing. Yeah, you can be too familiar.
Is there anything you can share here?
I think it was one of the best and the worst things early on. I think one of the biggest challenges is that you don't have a big enough business to be able to work on your own stuff. And there's too much overlap. I think for founders in general, there should be very clear separation of ownership and decision-making. And someone needs to be the classic YC question. I love this when they do the interview. Who's the boss? Someone needs to make the decision. And yes, the specific part of the business, whatever, but someone also needs to make a decision when it's overlapping and a bunch of stuff. I think that's so, so important. And I think it was really challenging with my brother and I, because we have a very dynamic relationship and those things never come up, right? You always consider, oh, like you decide this time, this thing. Like it doesn't, with friendships and with family, it's not like that. But in business, it is. So I think that was one of the most challenging pieces. I think the best piece is most companies fail because co-founder drama, especially early on when it's so hard and you're, you know, the example they just gave around, it's like wandering through hell and, you know, just not giving up. And I think the part about not giving up with each other and having that mutual commitment to a family member is very different than someone that you might have met recently or even worked with for a bit. And you don't have that commitment and integrity to. So I think that probably helped us figure out, you know, and continue that perseverance.
I also love that you obviously cut your teeth at Stripe, and there's a shining example of brothers who are running a company very successfully together.
Yeah, no, I think a good example too of like, you know, and you get bigger and then you get to own different parts of it. I think that's way healthier and easier. Like every year it gets easier and easier because it's like, this thing I'm working on, but like at the beginning, it's like so, and I didn't work there when it was like year one. Like I can't imagine brothers and like earlier in life, right? Like you learn lessons, how to work with other people through other jobs. Like we were, you know, in our late 20s, they were like in their late teens. So I can only imagine arguments that they had, you know, being at that stage of life and, you know, overlapping on so many key decisions. They probably both felt super strongly about.
It's so funny. My kids are at that age where I can imagine where they, you know, or like as a parent, imagine where they're going to be in 5 years or 10 years. It's like, yeah, they're still going to be fist fighting. You know, they're still going to be wrestling with each other. And I wonder if the Carlson brothers ever like argue about work stuff and they just attack with each other.
That changes. I mean, yeah, Ryan and I used to get into it with each other. And he was like 6'2 at like age 13. He was just like a freak of nature really early. And I was like, you know, normal size for my age. So that wasn't as fun. But that people grow up and change, you know, no one change. I don't think people really change, but you mature, you know, it shows up differently.
Yeah. Okay. What's your advice for other founders starting out?
If you're doing it, I think for a particular outcome, I don't think it's worth it. It's, for example, like there's a lot easier ways to make a lot of money with a certain likelihood. There's a lot easier things to do, I think, to feel fulfilled, to do all that stuff. If you feel like it's something you need to do, that's probably the only reason to do it. Like looking back, it was way harder than I thought it would be. I think I'm one of those people that eventually even, you know, told me that, like, I just do it and I'm glad I did. But I see a lot of people that give up in a year, in two, or feel like trapped by it and don't get a lot of fulfillment from it. I think make sure that you're doing it. Long story short, I think make sure you're doing it for the right reasons. And like, you feel like you need to, because again, like there's a lot of trade-offs in life that you make, like health-wise, you know, mental health-wise, physically, like it's just so time intensive. If you really want to go for it and be successful, and ask people to help you, and people will be willing to help you. So I just think, you know, making sure you're doing it for the right reasons, high integrity, that you're passionate about the space, and not just, you know, I think there's a lot of entrepreneurs out there that end up having like a very bad time and experience trying to start a company and realizing it's way harder, and then they have to shut it down, and that's probably not a lot of fun. So my advice would make sure it's going to be harder than you think. It's going to take more time. It's going to take more energy. It's going to take more trade-offs, you know, in life with friends and other things like that. But there's nothing like the feeling of, you know, building something and being proud of it, and, you know, of, again, the impact or why you went out to do in the first place. So
I agree with that. Let's close with this question. Tell us about one person who's helped you become the leader you are.
Wow, that's a big question. There's probably a lot of people. I feel bad almost, you know, saying one, because there's so many people that have been so helpful and impactful to the journey at different stages, right? Like, I'm sure when you think back to, you know, your last company and building, like, you know, every 6 months, there's probably someone who is like the person that helped you get to the next stage. Right now, it's probably my wife. Like, having, like, I started a company and we weren't even dating, and now we're married. Like, having someone in your life that's with you, that can support you and really build that like partnership, I think is so, so important. I probably couldn't be doing and have the empathy and space for other people on our team and all that kind of stuff without her. So I would say, yeah, I've learned a lot about myself and able to do what I do because of her.
As someone else's wife, I'm going to say that is an excellent answer, Ross. Same for me. I feel like my husband, who's also my co-founder of both my companies, he's just been my biggest supporter. And it's really, really helpful in those hard moments to have someone who is so on your team and just believes in you no matter what. Doesn't matter in those low, worst moments. They still believe in me. And it's it makes it easier to pick yourself up and just keep going.
Completely.
I'm glad you have that too.
Very important.
I could talk to you for another 2 hours. It's been really fun. We should do this again. Thank you so much for sharing everything about yourself and your journey.
No, it's fun. I'm usually on the other side asking questions, but it's great. I love these opportunities just to reflect, right? You know, like being forced to really think about this and share with someone who's, you know, also has been through it. So that was a lot of fun. Good to reflect, and hopefully I definitely learned a lot out of thinking about it. Hopefully other people out there that are listening, you know, also were able to learn.
Thank you, Ross.